We are the children of Cavan. Do you know that place? It is a border town, betwixt and between, a place of crossroads, and yet strangely few pass by there. The land around is low and sodden, a place of scrub and straggly pines, lanes and paths leading nowhere. The damp comes up through the soles of your boots and clots in the lungs. The town of Cavan itself has a wide main street of many fine buildings, and yet it seems the sun never shines at an angle to touch the stonework there. Walking the main street, you pass the Central Hotel, the Farnham Arms, Fagan's the Draper, and Sullivan's the General Store, and then, of course, the convent buildings and the orphanage. Those buildings are there, and yet they are not. But that place is never opened up, the nuns being a closed order, so though the many windows face onto the street, the glass is opaque and obscured by bars. The orphanage girls are never seen, except when they go to the cathedral for mass. And should you ever have cause to knock, the nun who unlocks the door will keep to the side, so that you may not see her, for that is the way of that world. It was the Sullivan family who knew of it first, sitting up late in the kitchen over a game of penny poker with some of their staff who lived then on the premises, as was the way at that time. And Louis Blessin was there, he that was famous for playing football, for he was gone on Sissy Riley, as worked the grocery counter. Over the road in Fagan's, the drapery store, yet others were still awake. A group of young men returned from a badminton party, lying several to a bed, laughing and joking yet. The street lights were off. The last guard of foot patrol was back at the station. The only man abroad was James Meehan, the taxi driver, who arrived at the Farnham Arms at exactly 10 to 2, he said later. Then, come 2 o'clock, that party at Sullivan's broke up. And then it was that Sissy Riley stood up from the card table, walked over to the window, pulled back the fringe velvet curtain, and looked out into the yard to see what weather they could expect the following day. Now Sullivan's, you must know, was next door to the convent and overlooked the orphanage. At first Sissy thought it was a low mist she saw. Others crowded by her to give their opinions. The night was clear, with no sight of stars, but a high, ragged moon with shreds of cloud racing past it. All were agreed. It was smoke. Smoke pumping out of a vent in the orphanage wall. In the Sacred Heart dormitory, we, orphanage girls, felt it first as a settling of boards, the scraping of a hinge, a sound like a yawn, a taste of ash at the back of the throat. But we were feared to get up. Many a night we had lain there, needing to relieve ourselves, but too frightened to go to the pot. So, though we heard Mary Caffrey's footsteps go to the cubicle to get Miss O'Reilly, still we lay rigid in our beds. The building was without light, only the moon slanting silver at the windows. Yet we heard Mary's feet go pat-pat again, down the wooden stairs to the first story, along the corridor, up another flight of stairs, to the cell of Sister Felix. Then a harsh noise broke on our ears, drilling into the restless night. It was the ringing of the doorbell at the convent, a sound we did not often hear. And this was a long ring. Then hardly a moment of silence, then another long ring, followed by many short jabs at the bell. Some of the girls, who were near to the windows, pulled themselves up on their beds, so that they might see out. "From the laundry," they said. "That's where it's coming." By then, some of us older girls had gone into St. Clair's dormitory, across the corridor, or even downstairs to our ladies. You would never generally have done such a thing, but by then it was not just the bell ringing. From outside the gate came shouting and a blunt thumping. You might have thought it was the sound of a fist slamming or a foot kicking, and perhaps it was at first. But soon we knew it must be an axe splitting the door. Suddenly the lights came on. We all stood blinking in our white nightdresses, standing between the six rows of iron beds. There was Veronica, Bernadette and the Cassidy girls, Mary and Susan McKiernan, and also Mary Lowry, who wore a gold cross around her neck. She had it as a prize from the bishop, for she had a calling, was soon to become a nun. Those up at the window whispered the news back to us. They saw Sister Felix with a key, which she gave to Mary Caffrey. Surely it was the key to the door to the main entrance of the convent. Then another noise, raucous, jaunty, a car horn, bleeping in short bursts again and again. Later it was recorded that it was Sissy Riley as started the banging, for how else could they wake the sleeping nuns and alert them to the danger? Then the man from Sullivan's, John McNally, was kicking at the door with stout boots. Until those young men from Fagan's drapery came, them who had returned from the badminton, and they brought an axe to smash it in. Some said it was 5 minutes they were there, others more like 10. But they could not get in. Louis Blessing, you know, the football player, he had run up the road to the Garda station to raise the alarm there. As he came running back, he found James Meehan, the taxi driver, who had been sleeping with his head on the car steering wheel. Louis shouted at him, "Drive down the car, drive it down." So Louis got into the passenger seat and they drove down together. Louis said, "Blast the horn, blast it loud." But James, still half asleep, did not take his meaning. So Louis leaned across and pressed on the horn again and again. When the taxi pulled up outside the convent gate, Louis said, "Quick, man, quick, drive on now, get your foot down to the house of Mr. Monaghan. Surely he will know how we can enter the building." Now, Mr. Monaghan was the convent's farm steward, and so was one of the few that came into those buildings. But then it was Mary Caffrey finally got the lock turned, and the door of the convent was opened. She waved her scattered arms then in the direction of the laundry, but John McNally was having none of that. "Get the children out. Do you not see? The fire is spreading." He spoke then to a nun, but she said, "No, no, no, you must go to the laundry first." So he said, "Give me the keys." But she had not any keys. John McNally said he looked up at the building, a place he had seen oft before through the windows of Sullivan's, so he knew what a maze it was. A knot of staircases and corridors, inside and out, wooden and metal. How might you find your way in or out? Yet there was the fire escape up on a wooden landing outside the upper dormitories. "We will try the fire escape," someone said. "You see if the laundry door will give." But a nun said, "No, no, come down off there. It is the fire in the laundry which must be put out." So then a group of them ran to the laundry door, but it was still locked. The nun said, "No, no, you must wait for the key." But the men knew better and kicked it in. Still, the nuns did not want anyone up the fire escape, but Louis and Sissy went up anyway. At the second floor, they were stopped again by a locked door into a classroom. Louis kicked at it, but it would not give, so they went back down to find something with which to break it in. Now, all this was said later when the inquiry came. By this time, we had gone back to the Sacred Heart dormitory and were waiting, our hands knotted together, the little ones, silent and hollow-eyed. Some stood up at the window, some sat on their beds, but some still had their heads under pillows, wanting to sleep. In that harsh and untimely light, it seemed that everything in that room sparkled. And perhaps it did. For everything in that convent shone. The floorboards, the iron beds, the wood of the cupboard doors, even the skirting boards and the ceilings themselves. We were clean girls. Miss O'Reilly then came into our dormitory, and she was not at all fussed. When she saw us at the window, she said, "Stop that now. Get on your knees and pray. Say an act of contrition." Miss O'Reilly then crossed over into St. Clair's. When she came back, she said, "You best go into the other dormitory, just until the doors and things get fixed up." So we ran back into St. Clair's, pulling the little ones with us. And the sound we made woke any there who were not yet out of bed. But we noticed even then how the girls got up, called out to find what the disturbance was, and then off did sink back into bed. Well, their heads were being sent funny by the smoke, I suppose, though we could see but little of it yet. Some of us crowded to the dormitory window. We saw the garter and a group who seemed to be arguing over a mop. Some others had gone into the infirmary and were carrying out the babies. Then suddenly the bottom door burst open and the girls started to pour out, their white nightdresses swelling as they ran, their hair long and straggling. They coughed and cried, stumbled, their eyes streaming, their hands gripped at their throats. They said later it was James Meehan who went to fetch the town's fire brigade. They came with a hand cart and some lengths of hose which had been given to them by the waterworks caretaker. Yet at this time they still could not get into the courtyard as the gate was not unlocked. So they had to break the parlour window in the convent and climb in that way. As they did so, others connected the hose to the standpipe in the street. It wasn't long before it was found that the hoses were leaking so badly that when the water was switched on, it could but dribble out. "Oh, my sister! My sister, I must get her down!" That cry came from Kathleen, looking for Bernadette. Other voices came up from the bottom of the wooden stairs, then banging and coughing, a sound of choking, but no one came up the stairs, only a wall of smoke. "We need a key for the fire escape. Where is the key?" Those words shouted over and over. "We need a gas mask. We'll not get through without..." We heard from the other side, where the door was, the way out of the fire escape, that is, and a frantic banging as though someone was trying to break through. They said to each other, "We must pray, we must say an act of contrition." But we could think of no prayers. We needed air. Oh, we needed air. Then, suddenly, all was dark. Not just the dormitory, but the courtyard down below, and all the convent too. then a door breaking somewhere close, and a rush of air which pushed the suffocating smoke further upon us. Another door opening, and another rush of smoke. We were blown back into the room by the force of it. Girls tumbled and scrambled, arms and legs locked. Oh, Lord, have mercy. Later, John McNally and his friend from Fagan's, John Paul Kennedy, told how they'd got into the laundry and attacked the clothes dryer. For that was the source of the fire, they thought. When the extinguishers were empty, they came out, gasping for air. One of the nuns begged McNally, "Come now, like a good boy, go in and try again." He asked for a wet cloth, and Monaghan tied it around his nose and mouth. Armed again with extinguishers brought now from Sullivan's store, he went back into the laundry, where, he said, the wooden walls were crackling with flames. But he soon fell senseless, and Kennedy had to drag him out. "Come out! Come out this way! The fire escape is open!" It was Mary Caffrey's voice. But we could not find the way, for the smoke was curdling thick. Then Una Smith said, "What if there are still girls in Sacred Heart? How do we know that all came out?" So some of us went with her to check. With the tarry smoke and the solid dark, we could see naught. But we ran our hands over the beds, working down all six rows. So it was there we found Dolly Duffy, who was deaf, so we pulled her out. We were crossing back to St. Clair's, but we could not see the way. "It is this way out," said Una, but we said no, no, for she was running into solid, gusting smoke. We called after her, but it was too late, she'd gone. Then Dolly Duffy said, "It is better this way, down the wooden stairs, come on, we must run or we shall burn." But we said no, no, for we knew that all below was alight. But Dolly Duffy picked up an apron, wrapped it over her head, rushed through an act of contrition, and though we pleaded and pleaded, she ran away from us down the wooden stairs. Later it was the testimony of John McNally that when he recovered consciousness he asked, "The children are out, are they not? You have got the children out." He was shouting it then at those who stood all about, but no one wanted to reply until he shook Monaghan by the collar. "No, no," said Monaghan. "There are still children up there. Here, take the keys, see what you may do. May the blessed Mary have mercy upon us." So McNally went up the iron staircase, but the smoke was too dense. It was just as he turned to come down, he said, he saw a girl burst out of the other door, the soles of her feet burning. She ran screaming across the courtyard, her arms waving, screaming and screaming, her feet blazing fire. 40 feet up to our dormitory. We knew we were trapped, and yet we said, "Get the youngest children out, that's what we must do." So we pushed them ahead of us towards the closed door. We pulled it open, but so strangling and grasping were the fumes which burst in, we could only push it shut again, our eyes stinging and swollen. We tried then to get to the window, crawling over beds or under them, keeping low to the floor, until we were looking down into the courtyard. There all was chaos and commotion, with many people running to and fro. We heard them shout that the ladders were coming. We opened the windows, bashed on the sections which did not give, Some of us sat on the beds and gathered the smaller children around us. We began to lead them in a decade of the rosary. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Those down below knew that ladders were the only hope. So they ran through the unlit streets to the market yard, where the town council kept ladders, and tried to raise the caretaker. After much yelling and bashing, a window was opened. The caretaker was angry to be woken, so flung the keys down, and they were lost in the dark. Louis Blessin, by then, had found a bicycle, he said, and pedalled furiously up to the Central Hotel, where he and several other bachelors in the town had rooms. He burst into Matty Hahn's room, shouting and roaring, grabbing hold of Matty's shoulder, pulled him from the bed. "What are you doing, you blessed fool?" apparently Matty said, thinking this was some sort of jest. But soon enough, he understood. Matty Hahn's worked with the Electricity Supply Board, and had ladders in the back of his van. While he dressed, Louis cycled back to the market yard, where people were still stumbling around, trying to find the key. But it was hopeless in the dark, so finally the men smashed open the door to the yard and seized upon the ladders that they found. On their way back to the orphanage, they met a squad of soldiers, brought out of the town barracks, now quick marching in formation up the main street. Coming into the courtyard, the men with ladders and the soldiers found a crowd gripped by panic. Sparks, fireballs, pieces of slate were raining down, flames and smoke billowed out of every window. The three top windows were crowded with a sea of young faces, screaming, praying, coughing, calling out, "Get us out, we are smothering." Then it was a girl jumped, rising up first, so it seemed, like some great white bird, then dipping down, falling faster and faster through the air. Even the blankets spread out below could not break her fall. We were trying to say the rosary again. Dear Lord, we were trying. But the little children were all screaming. Once again, some of us went to the door and tried to open it, but we were suffocated by smoke. Mary Lowry, with her gold chain still around her neck, dropped to the floor. Kathleen crawled under the beds to the window. When we were halfway through the third decade of the rosary, we could go no further, so we joined those others then at the window. I'm ashamed to say that we were treading on the younger children who had been knocked senseless by the fumes. We could not do otherwise, as we must have air. We saw down below poor Maureen, who had jumped, and Miss Harrington standing near her. But Miss Harrington never went to pick her up. No, it was Dolly Duffy, though her feet were burnt black. She was the one as went to pick up poor, broken Maureen. Then we saw men putting up a ladder against the wall, but it fell short of the window. "See, it does not reach," we called. "How will we get down?" We saw the men and the soldiers struggling to extend the ladders. One went up partially, but did not reach our window and came off the pulleys. Another had ropes around it. They got them untangled, but still it would not extend. So they lashed the two pieces together, but as it went up, it soon swayed and fell apart. Then a rush and a crash as the wooden stairs below us collapsed. The men were calling up, telling us to jump. We said, "No, it's too far down." But still another did jump. The man tried his best to hold her, but she too crashed down, smashing her legs. To one side there was a lean-to shed, and one girl tried to jump onto there, but she bounced off and hit the ground. After that, none of us wanted to jump. A section of the council ladder was placed on the roof of the lean-to shed. One man climbed up and stood close to the window. "Come on, girl, come on, jump, jump." So one did, and then another and another. But when the fourth jumped, the man lost his balance and he and the child fell on the shed roof and the ladder crashed to the ground. Only those of us on the windowsill now were left. Oh, praise God! A man came with a better ladder. Got it extended in seconds. Though we were throat raw and suffocated, still we were afeard to go, but he put out his hands and pulled some of us off, placing us on the ladder so that we might get down. When it came to the turn of Bernadette, who was but 7 years old, she tried to go back into the room, such was her terror. Teresa, it was, went after her, Bernadette wriggling her way back into the flames. There was only a tiny patch of floor left, so Teresa was forced to get hold of her by the hair and drag her hand towards the man on the ladder. He got her down, but by then her back and hair were flaming alight. At the inquiry, it was explained that it was Matty Hands who finally got the ladders up. Also Dr. John Sullivan, brother of those Sullivans who owned the store. When he got abreast of the window, it was pumping tarry smoke. He'd only time to look through for one moment. A heap of children struggling about the level of the window. Cries were still coming there. But he could not breathe, and came a step or two down the ladder, putting his head under the window sill where the air was clearer. As he hung there, he heard the groans, cries from within. Again he pulled his head over the sill, but he could see little, and the smoke was making him weak. "I would have done anything on this earth to get in, but I couldn't do it," he said. As he came down the ladder, flames smashed out through the window above. A roar, a heaving, a smash of timbers. Another as the roof blew right into the night. He called and called, shouting until his voice was hoarse. But no voice from the window echoed back to him. The time? 2:40 a.m. The next day, the orphanage was nothing but a burnt-out frame, with damp wisps of smoke curling out through the debris. Only the many iron beds could you still see standing, stuck up in curved shapes like the rib cages of so many skeleton beasts, and a pile of hoops lying in the yard. All the business premises in the town were closed, and a sickening smell spread all about. Matt McKiernan, the brother of Mary and Susan, who lived 12 miles from Cavan, was told of the fire that morning and pedalled furiously to the post office at Butler's Bridge and called to the Garda, who told him then that his sisters were both dead. Although it was Lent at that time and many were on the tack, yet they did take to the liquor that day. It was not until darkness was falling that the bodies were brought out. Then the men shouldered the coffins and took them to the convent chapel, laid them down near the altar. Over the days that followed, donations flooded in to the bishop and the abbess from all around. Yet no one thought to get a call through to Matt McKiernan and his brother Hugh, who had lost their two sisters. So when the family came into the town to the funeral, the procession had already gone out to Cully's graveyard. But Mrs. Carroll, who had lost two daughters, now she was at the funeral, gripping the hand of her surviving daughter, who she had dressed in a scarlet coat. "I'll never step into a Catholic church again, as long as I live," she said. Later we were asked, those of us who still had tongues to speak, about what happened, for an inquiry was established by Judge McCarthy, sent up from Dublin. "You must say your age and your work within the orphanage, cook, portress, maid, needleworker, laundress. Even though you fainted, you must go back the next day." Just as we had learnt the catechism, so the nuns taught us what we must say. At least for the inquiry, no one had to walk out in two left boots, as was often the way. It was said, "Of course, many of those orphan girls are simple." But we were not simple. We were frightened. Nuns with the rosary on their wrist, the cane hanging next to it. Mother Carmel would strip your clothes from your body, beat you skinless. We were asked again and again, "You knew the instructions in case of a fire, so why did you not follow those procedures?" Yet that question was never asked of the nuns. It was a pitiful business, when all was told. That was widely agreed. It was said in town, "The brigade were not fit to wash a bus." It was also said privately, "Of course, the building burnt so fast due to all that floor polish." Yet the council were able to reassure the inquiry that faulty equipment had played no part. The ladders and the hoses were all in excellent order. Questions were asked about the fire escape. It was but 7 foot away from the dormitory, so why were the children not able to get out? And the lights in the building, why were they switched off? Miss O'Reilly was questioned at some length. Was there not full 15 minutes during which those children could have been brought down? Miss O'Reilly could not say. The questioning made her confused. She was also the sister of the Mother Abbess, and so must be treated with respect. Which nun was it who had tried to prevent the men from going up the fire escape? They asked. No, that was not what happened. The question could not be pursued. Nor was it asked why some of those girls were ever in the orphanage, for many were not orphans. Susan and Mary McKinnon had brothers and a father, but after their mother died, they were sent to the orphanage. Apparently, a neighbour had offered to take them, and that woman was a Protestant, so she was not allowed. Yet in truth, you could not blame the nuns. Sure, they took those children in, and the state gave them no money for it. They were good women who did their best. Yet still in the town it was whispered. It was because those girls must not be seen in their nightdresses by the men of the town. We are the children of Cavan. Have you heard speak of us? From all around they saw us burn, but none could help. Now, and in the hour of our death. Sure, it was discipline and fear which killed us, not the wire in the laundry clothes dryer. We are still waiting at the window, and Louis Blessing is still bashing at the fire escape with a mop. And Matt McKiernan is still riding his bike to Butler's Bridge, and the phone call that will stake his heart. John McNally, please, please will you bring the ladder up to us? Or must we run to heaven with our feet on fire? They put on our gravestones, children, pray for us. 35 girls, but only 8 coffins. It was only Mary Lowry they could identify, her with the gold cross she had from the bishop. All the nuns were safe enough, so God be praised. Many years have passed now, it was long ago, but we are still waiting. Will you not put up the ladders and bring us down?